Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And on Free for All Friday, we talk about all kinds of fascinating, eclectic topics that interest me and I think will interest you as well. So let's dive into it. I love when I do research into all different kinds of non-Catholic topics. And usually this happens after my wife goes to bed and my kids go to bed. I always regret it later. I don't really regret it, but I stay up late because I love when everybody's asleep and the house is quiet and I just hear the one little oscillating fan in the living room going back and forth. And then I open up my laptop and I start browsing Wikipedia, browsing YouTube, going through websites like Atlas Obscura is a fun one, and just other websites to look at interesting trivia and other kinds of subjects. And one that I always enjoy looking at are mysteries. If you've looked at Free for All Fridays here in the past, you know there are some common topics I end up hitting over and over again. I haven't done a Disney topic in a while because Disneyland has been closed. So maybe if it reopens amidst the pandemic, we'll do another Disney episode. Or even if it doesn't, there's all kinds of lore related to Disney I still haven't shared with you yet. I also enjoy studying mythology and ancient folklore. So we'll cover some of that in today's episode. And also, I enjoy mysteries. So whether it's supernatural mysteries or paranormal mysteries or even just true crime or unsolved crime, mysteries are something I love sitting down. Though sometimes I get freaked out at night when I look up the true crime stories and I'm, you know, just sitting in our living room. And it's mostly our living room is a lot of glass windows. So it's not a lot of walls, actually, because we live in a tiny, tiny house in San Diego. If you're going to live here, you know, you're going to end up, unless you're a person of means, you're going to end up living in a pretty small place. And our house is something like 1,200 square feet. But it's nice, small, and cozy. And honestly, some of the holiest Catholic families I know had a bunch of kids living in a small house. And so I'm excited for that for my kiddos. In fact, I'm excited now that we're having a boy in September, that we're having three boys. And so aside from the fact it's going to be kind of a smelly, testosterone-filled, rowdy, things will get broken house, I love the fact that we can kind of cram all of them in there together. I was going on Amazon a few days ago looking at bunk beds. And I think it's time now for my two older boys, Matthew and Thomas, they might get their own room together and share bunk beds. But eventually, when our third boy, John Paul, gets older, I was looking on Amazon saying, oh, a triple bunk bed. Like, I mean, we're in a tiny house, but they could all have their one little room together with the triple bunk bed. I remember growing up in Phoenix, and I was friends with Catholic families that had 10 or 11 or 12 kids. And there would just be rooms that looked like army barracks that had, you know, two or three. I think, I don't know if it had three, but it had like two triple bunk beds in each room. So it just looked like an army barracks, basically, everybody sleeping in there. But there were homes that were full of love. And I want that for my kiddos. So I was, you know, when I'm staying up late, it's a small house. And there's not a lot of room, but it's used efficiently. So there's a lot of windows. So I'm going to be watching these true crime stories. And it's just like, and then the killer snuck in through the attic and hacked up the family during the night. Then I'm like looking around like, did I set the alarm before I went to bed? Somehow I turned into Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, I guess. Zoink, Scoobs! I don't like the looks of the what's going on out there. Yeah, Raggy. But I still love looking at the true crime. So I'm going to cover a little bit of true crime and a little bit of folklore, how it mixes together in the topic of today's episode, which is the mystery of the changelings. So we'll start with folklore and ancient mythology. I love reading about that in other different cultures. And some of it even ends up in modern film and art. There's a film, if you haven't seen it, if you like foreign films, foreign language films, you should try this one out. It's called Troll Hunter. It's a 2010 film. It's a Norwegian film, and everybody in the movie speaks Norwegian, but you can still follow the plot really well. It's a found footage movie, so it's kind of like the Blair Witch Project. It's about three college students who are trying to go into the Norwegian countryside to follow this guy who they've heard is a troll hunter, and they follow him, and then they find out that trolls are real, that the trolls are like monsters, they're dangerous. They like hide under bridges, or they hide in the woods, or there's some that are even as big as mountains, and it kind of explores troll lore and fantasy. It's actually very common in the Scandinavian countries, especially in Norway and Sweden and the other Nordic countries. So Troll Hunter, that's a fun one. You should definitely go and check out. But the folklore that I want to talk about today are the changelings. So what is a changeling? According to this article, a changeling, also historically referred to as an off or oaf, is a human-like creature found in folklore and folk religion throughout Europe. A changeling was believed to be a fairy child that had been left in place of a human child stolen by the fairies. The theme of the swap child is common in medieval literature and reflects concern over infants thought to be afflicted with unexplained diseases, disorders, or developmental disabilities. So the idea here with the changelings is that your baby gets sick or starts to develop a developmental disability. It could even be something like Down syndrome or autism. Changelings seem to be frequently used as an explanation to explain why some children today, we would say, had autism, why they had certain developmental abnormalities or behavioral disorders or other kinds of physical ailments. Changelings might have also been invoked to explain diseases like progeria, which is a rapidly advanced aging disease. You know why? You know, children, as they get older, they start to look like, you know, essentially they look decades older than they really are, you know, kind of like that movie Benjamin Button, if you know, the Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And one of my favorite quotes from The Office, I think it was from The Office, he said, you know, my life is just like Benjamin Button in reverse. So Benjamin Button is the story about a man who is born, when he's born, he's like 80 years old, 90 years old. When he's like one or two, he has like the body of like a 80-year-old man. And as he gets older, he gets younger. So middle age, he's middle aged, but near the end of his life, he keeps getting younger and younger, turns into a child, and then back into a kid again. So so progeria is an advanced aging disease where children seem to get, they appear older and their bodies break down faster than other children do. And so one explanation in medieval Europe, when you saw that your child had one of these behavioral or developmental abnormalities, was the thought that that actually is not your child, that a fairy or some other kind of mythical creature had stolen your child and replaced it with a lookalike. And then the lookalike ends up revealing their true colors because they act out in abnormal ways, or you know, they end up having these physical abnormalities. And so that's where the changeling folklore came into popularity. It was enshrined, one of its earliest elements where changeling folklore was enshrined was in the 1549 Ballad of Tam Lin. And this is an excerpt of it, which refers to this idea of swapping a child from hell or among the fairies, or one of those children from the underworld with a child, or even an older child or adult in the world of men, is what it says. And once it fell upon a day, a cold day in a snell, windy and sharp, when we were from the hunting come, that from my horse I fell. The queen of fairies, she caught me in yon green hill to dwell. And pleasant is the fairy land, but an eerie tale to tell. At the end of every 7 years, we pay a tithe to hell. I am so fair and firm of flesh, I'm feared it be myself. The tithe to hell is the reference to the changelings, that the fairies would go and they would kidnap a baby among the world of men and pay that as the tithe to hell and replace the baby with one of their own fairy children. According to this article, the tale is notably retold by Swedish children's story author Helena Nibblom in the story, I'm going to totally butcher this, the Bortebitjengarna, I'm the Swedish chef now, the Bortebitjengarna, in the 1913 book Bland Tamar och Troll. In it, a princess is kidnapped by trolls and replaced with their own offspring against the wishes of the troll mother. The changelings grow up with their new parents, but both find it hard to adapt. The human girl is disgusted by her future bridegroom, a troll prince. So what's happened here is you have a human princess and a troll princess. They're swapped. And so in the story, the human princess is disgusted with the troll prince she's supposed to marry, whereas the troll girl is bored by her life and by her dull human future groom. So she wants a rowdy, she wants a rowdy groom, a rowdy husband, and her human husband just can't suffice for her. Upset with the conditions of their lives, they both go astray in the forest, passing each other without noticing it. The princess comes to the castle, whereupon the queen immediately recognizes her, and the troll girl finds a troll woman who is cursing loudly as she works. The troll girl bursts out that the troll woman is much more fun than any other person she has ever seen, and her mother happily sees that her true daughter has returned. Both the human girl and the troll girl marry happily the very same day. So that's the folklore of the changelings. And now, if you remember, several years ago, there was actually a movie that came out starring Angelina Jolie called Changeling. And it refers to a true crime story about the disappearance of Walter Collins and his replacement with a lookalike. So we've talked about the changelings in folklore and mythology. So what I'm going to do now is follow up with the true crime elements that have changeling elements in them, which involve missing. There's two stories from the early part of the 20th century here in America, two true crime stories that really gripped the nation, actually. And they deal with changeling elements where you have a missing child, a child who has gone missing, and allegations, not just allegations, it turns out they were replaced by lookalikes. So the first story is Walter Collins, who is the son of Christine Collins. Christine Collins' son disappeared on March 10th, 1928, after she gave him money to go to the cinema. Walter's disappearance received nationwide attention, and the Los Angeles Police Department followed up on hundreds of leads without success. The police faced negative publicity and increasing public pressure to solve the case until 5 months after Walter's disappearance, when a boy claiming to be Walter was found in DeKalb, Illinois. Letters and photographs were exchanged before Christine Collins paid for the boy to be brought to Los Angeles. At the reunion, Collins said that the boy was not Walter. So there's actually, here's the scene from the movie Changeling with Angelina Jolie that dramatizes this moment. So her son, her 9-year-old son, Walter Collins, goes missing. And then they go, and then so 5 months later, they say, "We found your son." Imagine as a mother how, you'd be so distraught and so relieved. And she's running to the train station, running down the platform to go and see what she thinks is her son. And the boy they put forward is not her son. But everyone, this is, this is 1928. And so I've done this before, this is misogynistic, Trent. Christine, you're just a simple woman who's obviously prone to hysterics. You just don't recognize the boy. Oh, calm down now, woman. We've done a good job here. But that's how they treated her at that time when she said, "No, this isn't my son." So here's a dramatization of when she is reunited with the fake Walter Collins at the train station. And with her is LAPD Captain J.J. Jones, who tries to convince her to go along with this.
"Well, aren't you gonna..."
"It's not my son."
"What? What are you saying?"
"It's not my son."
"Oh, I'm sure you're mistaken."
"I'm not mistaken."
"Well, he's been through 5 terrible long months. He's lost weight. He's changed."
"I wouldn't know my own son."
"All I'm saying is you're in shock and he's changed."
"What's your name? Can you tell me your name?"
"Walter Collins."
"It's a common name."
"Where do you live, Walter? You know your home address?"
"I live at 210 Avenue 23, Los Angeles, California. And that's my mommy."
"Mrs. Collins, listen to me. I understand. You're feeling a little uncertain right now, and that's to be expected. Boy this age, it changes so fast. We've compensated for that in our investigation. And there's no question that this is your son."
"That is not Walter."
"It's not Walter as you remember him. And that's why it's important for you to take him home on a trial basis."
"A trial basis?"
"Yes, yes. Once he's around his familiar surroundings, and you've given yourself time to recover from the shock of his changed condition, you will see that this is your Walter. Now, I promise you, I swear to you, I give you my word, this is your son."
Now- So even the way he sounds like misogynistic 1920s Trent. Obviously, your lady parts have sucked away all the blood from your brain, my dear. This is clearly your son. But look, look. Just try him out. 30-day trial run, and then you can return him. In the real story, when they brought fake Walter Collins to Christine to try to prove that this was her son, they tried to do a test where they brought the dog out. They brought out the family dog, and the dog ran up to the boy and, like, licked him and stuff. And he's like, well, see here, the dog recognizes the boy. Clearly, he's your son. Except dogs will probably run up to any 9-year-old boy and just be like, oh, yay, a little boy who will play with me. So she takes him home and she goes along with this. But then she returned to J.J. Jones 3 weeks later and said, you know, this is not my son. And she had dental records proving that it was not her son, testimony from her son's teacher saying this is not her son. And so Jones apologized and had this runaway sent back to his home and helped Collins to go find a real son. No, I'm just kidding. This is the corrupt LAPD of the early 1920s. Instead, Collins told Jones that she was a bad mother and that she was trying to pawn off her son to the police. What are you trying to say? This isn't your son. You're a terrible mother. You're just trying to get us to raise your boy when you should be doing it. I'm having you interned. And that's what they did. They used a code 12 internment. So Captain J.J. Jones said, all right, I'm using a code 12 internment, which means a citizen who harasses members of the Los Angeles Police Department, and harass can be taken very loosely, can just be placed in a psychiatric ward at the L.A. County Hospital indefinitely. And so she was taken there and put in the insane asylum, essentially. But later, Jones then questioned this boy who was not 9-year-old Walter Collins. He was actually 12-year-old Arthur Hutchins Jr., a runaway from Iowa. It's like, oh, clearly he's your boy. You know, what's your name, son? Walter Collins. You know, like any 12-year-old can know to say that. Or a 12-year-old has been listening to people and knows the address that he's going to. And so he admitted to being Arthur Hutchins Jr. and that he, why did he do it? Well, he lied and said that he was Walter Collins just so that he could get a free trip to Hollywood to meet his favorite actor, Tom Mix. So then Collins was released 10 days after Hutchins admitted he was not her son. And then Collins later filed a lawsuit against the LA County Police Department. Collins won the lawsuit against Captain Jones and was awarded $10,800, which would be worth a lot of money today. I mean, I don't have an inflation calculator off the top of my head, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was like $100,000 today, which Captain J.J. Jones never ended up paying. So what happened to Walter, though? What happened to Walter Collins? Well, Christine Collins dedicated her life to searching for him and never found him. So we don't know what happened to him. But one prevailing theory was that he ended up, and this is a theory that's endorsed in the Changeling film starring Angelina Jolie, was that he was a victim of a serial killer at the time, Gordon Stewart Northcott. In 1929, Gordon Stewart Northcott was found guilty of abducting, molesting, and killing 3 young boys in what became known as the Winesville Chicken Coop murders. Northcott's mother, Sarah Louise Northcott, confessed in late 1928 to her participation in the murder of Walter Collins among her son's victims. Following her confession, she was sentenced without trial to life imprisonment for her role in Walter's death. The state chose not to prosecute Gordon Northcott for Walter's murder and instead brought him to trial for the murders of 3 other young boys for which there was forensic evidence. On February 13, 1929, he was found guilty for all 3 murders and sentenced to death. So he would kidnap these young boys, and he kept them, I think, locked up in a chicken coop on a farm property he was working at in Winesville, which is just outside of Los Angeles. And then later, another relative came to notice what was happening here. I think he was being abused, actually, by Gordon, maybe like his nephew or something. And then Gordon would abuse him. And when he got too old for the abuse to be enjoyable for Gordon, he used him to kidnap these other young boys to molest them and then ended up killing them. Collins, so Walter and Sarah Northcott later attempted to rescind her confession and gave scattered, inconsistent statements. Collins chose to believe that her son was still alive and corresponded with Gordon Northcott and received permission to interview him shortly before his execution. Northcott pledged to explain the true account of her son's fate, but he recanted at the last minute and professed innocent of any involvement. Collins was further encouraged by the appearance of another boy that Northcott had abducted and probably molested. So the police, a lot of people think that Collins had been killed by Northcott and they never owned up to it, but Collins chose to believe that he may have escaped like other boys had and maybe went on to assume a new identity or become part of a new family or run away in another town after that. And she continued to search for him for the rest of her life, and she never found him. But it's still a very powerful story and a powerful movie to see with Angelina Jolie, the movie Changeling. And it's still just a bizarre case when you're talking about someone disappearing and then the police replacing them with a lookalike and saying you're crazy for saying this is clearly my son. I mean, it's one thing if, let's say, like an infant were abducted, like your infant was abducted, and then later the police come and bring an infant and you say, that's not my child. I'm sorry, I know this sounds bad, but all babies kind of look alike. I mean, people always show, my wife always shows me pictures and says, oh, look at this new baby so-and-so had. And I'm like, it just kind of looks like an old man. I mean, yeah, they're cute. They are, obviously babies are cute. But for me, it's hard when you've seen one newborn baby, you've kind of seen them all. You know, they all kind of look the same. So I can imagine if an infant had been abducted, it would be hard maybe to say, yeah, that's definitely my child. That's why you do, you know, the foot ink prints, you know, the footprints at the hospital, and they've got the bands that you put around them. When my son Matthew was born, it's so funny. I had this fear that like someone would take him. And I remember just like staying up all night looking at the door thinking like somebody was going to come in and kidnap my baby. But when you have like a 9-year-old child, I mean, to think like you can't recognize a 9-year-old child. I mean, they're a lot more developed and grown. That would be pretty unheard of to say, like, you know, no, that's not your child. You're going to say a mother can't recognize her own 9-year-old child? No, I'm telling you, she's just a hysterical woman. Ever since we gave those dames the right to vote, they're going to walk all over us. Quiet, misogynistic Trent. Go back to the 1920s and your flapper's culture where you belong. But there's another changeling story that fits around in the same time period. It happened about 20 years earlier, and it's the mysterious disappearance of Bobby Dunbar. So Robert Clarence Bobby Dunbar was the first son to Leslie and Percy Dunbar in Opelousas, Louisiana. In August of 1912, the Dunbars took a fishing trip to Swayze Lake in St. Landry Parish. On August 23rd, while on that trip, Bobby Dunbar disappeared. So what happened was they were all going out to the lake, and they started walking back with a family friend. There was a group of other children there, and they're kind of walking through the bayou, and they go, and the kids just go to play hide and seek. And then the grown-ups try to go and find them. And then during that time, Bobby Dunbar goes missing, and they look around and they try to find him, and they don't know what happened to him. Now, he was 4 years old at the time, and so a prevailing theory was that he either fell into the water in the bayou and drowned, or he fell into the water and was eaten by a crocodile or an alligator. But one piece of evidence against this theory was that Bobby Dunbar was wearing a straw hat when he was playing with everyone and when he went missing. So the theory was that if he had fallen into the water and been eaten by a crocodile or fell in the water, the straw hat would have still been floating around. It's not like he was gone for hours and hours. He was only gone for a few minutes. And then people went and started looking for him. So they actually did an experiment at the time. They took a similar straw hat and put it in the water and saw it would float for several hours before it ended up sinking. So if he fell in the water, they figured that they would have found his straw hat floating nearby, but they didn't. But still, a lot of people said, look, maybe an alligator got him and ate the hat along with it, or something else happened. You don't want to hang your hat, so to speak, on just this one piece of evidence. Another theory, though, was that Bobby was kidnapped by someone, that someone kidnapped him, put him in a boat, and left through the bayou. And so this theory that he had been kidnapped was bolstered because after an 8-month search, authorities located William Cantwell Walters, who worked as an itinerant handyman specializing in the tuning and repair of pianos. Walter had been traveling through Mississippi with a boy who appeared to match the description of Bobby Dunbar. Walters claimed that the boy was actually Charles Bruce Anderson, generally referred to as Bruce, the son of a woman who worked for his family. He said that the boy's mother was named Julia Anderson and that she had willingly granted him custody. Julia Anderson would later confirm this. Nonetheless, Walters was arrested and authorities sent for the Dunbars to come to Mississippi and attempt to identify the boy. And so if you go to online and look at the pictures, they actually do look somewhat similar. They have kind of similar eyes and, you know, chubby cheeks. You have a picture of Bobby Dunbar. There's actually in a newspaper account in 1914. There's a cutout picture of Bobby Dunbar's face and this boy named Bruce Anderson, allegedly Bruce Anderson, who was found at the same time, pictured next to each other. And they do look kind of similar. So at least, but even for me, like I feel like my 4-year-old son, well, now he's five, I have a 3 and a 5-year-old. I feel like those two are so incredibly unique as children. I couldn't imagine ever finding anyone else who looks like them. I mean, we once were amazed when we went to the Science Center and there was a boy there with blonde curly hair like Matthew's, because we've never seen anybody with hair like his. And even that family was like, we've never met anybody who has curly, you know, blonde curly hair that's just like our son. So I couldn't imagine it with my children. But here in the case of the Dunbars, the child that they found, who was named Bruce Anderson, did look a lot like Bobby Dunbar. So newspaper accounts differ with regard to the initial reaction between the boy and Leslie Dunbar, Bobby Dunbar's mother. While one account, which is almost entirely fictional, said that the boy shouted mother upon seeing her, other accounts said that the Dunbars had doubts to the boy's identity, that they brought him in and he was just crying, he didn't embrace his mother. But eventually, after giving him a bath, they said, yes, we believe that this is our son. And then Julia Anderson came down to Mississippi saying, no, this is my son. And she was a poor woman. She couldn't afford a good attorney. She said that William Walters was only granted permission to take her son for a few days on a trip, not for several months. And so she tried to reclaim her son. But when she was presented with five different boys who were about the same age and height as her son, she first had doubts and wasn't sure which one was her son, though she had been traveling all night in order to get there. She was tired, she was fatigued, she was stressed, and so she probably wasn't in the proper frame of mind to do that kind of an identification. And so regardless, she didn't have money to sustain a lengthy court battle, and the court eventually determined that the boy was not Bruce Anderson, but he was actually Bobby Dunbar. And so he lived out the rest of his life according to that name. And so ever since then, so even 90 years later, there's been kind of a disagreement between the Dunbar clan and the Anderson clan, that these families are aware of each other and have held to competing narratives. The Dunbars believe that this boy was Bobby Dunbar, who had been retrieved after being kidnapped for several months. And the Andersons saying, no, he was Bruce Anderson, that you guys kidnapped him, called him Bobby Dunbar, but he was taken away from his actual biological mother and raised as another woman's child. And then this was later resolved with DNA testing just a few years ago. In 2004, Bobby Dunbar's granddaughter looked into the case and attempted to resolve it. So an Associated Press reporter approached the family, and Bob Dunbar Jr., the son of Bobby Dunbar, consented to undergoing DNA tests to resolve the issue. The results showed that Dunbar Jr. was not related by blood to his supposed cousin, the son of Alonzo Dunbar, who was the younger brother of Bobby Dunbar Sr., so of the Bobby Dunbar who actually turned out to be Bruce Anderson. Since the DNA testing is conclusive, the fate of the real Bobby Dunbar remains unknown. And this is covered in a story on This American Life, the Ira Glass audio documentary series, in March 14, 2008, called The Ghost of Bobby Dunbar. So these are the interviews and how they describe how those events transpired.
The plan was to keep the results sealed until all Bob's siblings agreed to open them. A month passed.
I called to check with the laboratory, and the laboratory assistant ended up blurting to me the results over the phone. The DNA did not match. You know, as far as she was concerned, it was a paternity test. You know, she had no idea the impact of what she was saying to me. It was a shock to me. Not really the conclusion, but to hear it.
Margaret got off the phone and drove 10 hours that day to tell her father in person. He was still in the hospital.
It took my breath away. You know, I hadn't considered that. My thought was to prove that Daddy was Bobby Dunbar. So it took me, well, I had a lot of time. I was in the hospital a while, and I just pondered, you know, and all right, if my past is wrong, Bobby Dunbar, all the legends, all the stories, and then all of a sudden you find out, well, that's not who your blood says you are. Where does that leave me? You know.
Fascinating mystery to be sure. And I will include links to the story about Walter Collins and Bobby Dunbar at trenthornpodcast.com. So if you want to go and check that out and listen to the full Ira Glass documentary or watch the movie Changelings, for example, I think you'll find the stories to be really fascinating. And hey, if you have an idea for a future Free for All Friday episode and you're a subscriber at trenthornpodcast.com, be sure to leave an idea for me there. I'll probably leave a post soon asking for Free for All Friday ideas in general from our patrons. If you're not a patron, be sure to go and check it out. For as little as $5 a month, you make the podcast possible, and you can send me ideas for future episodes. I love getting them from my patrons, so I'll probably be asking the patrons soon for Free for All Friday topic ideas, but you can also leave your thoughts on this episode and your topics for future Free for All Fridays, at the very least, in the comments under the mystery of the changelings at trenthornpodcast.com. So thank you all so much. I really enjoyed doing this episode today. I hope you have a very blessed day and a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.